Retrieve the jewels from the safety deposit box. Find the itemized list for the caterer. The new invitation, designed by Ashima, the English translation lettered by Gogol, is the only thing that isn't a leftover. Since Moshimi has to teach a class 3 days after the wedding, they have to postpone the honeymoon. The closest they come is a night alone in the Doubletree, which they are dying to leave. But their parents have gone to great trouble and expense to book the newlywed suite. "I have got to take a shower," she says as soon as they are finally alone, and disappears into the bathroom. He knows she is exhausted, as he is. The night had ended with a long session of dancing to ABBA songs. He examines the room, opening drawers and pulling out the stationery, opening the minibar, reading the contents of the room service menu, though he's not at all hungry. If anything, he feels slightly ill from the combination of the bourbon and the two large pieces of cake he'd had because he had not had any dinner. He sprawls on the king-sized bed. The bedspread had been strewn with flower petals, a final gesture before their families withdrew. He waits for her, flipping through the channels on the television. Beside him is a bottle of champagne in a bucket, heart-shaped chocolates on a lace-covered plate. He takes a bite out of one of the chocolates. The inside is an unyielding toffee, requiring more chewing than he expects. He fidgets with the gold ring she'd placed on his finger after they cut the cake, identical to the one he'd placed on hers. He'd proposed to her on her birthday, giving her a diamond solitaire in addition to the hat he'd bought for her after their second date. He'd made a production out of it, using her birthday as an excuse to take her to a country inn for the weekend, in a town upstate on the banks of the Hudson, the first trip they'd taken together that wasn't to her parents' place in New Jersey or to Pemberton Road. It was springtime, the velvet hat out of season by then. She'd been overwhelmed that he'd remembered it all this time. "I can't believe the store still had it," she said. He didn't tell her the truth about when he'd bought the hat. He had presented it to her downstairs, in the dining room, after a Chateaubriand that had been carved for them at the table. Strangers turned to admire Moshimi when the hat was on her head. After trying it on, she'd put the box away under her chair, not noticing the smaller box lost among the tissue. "There's something else in there," he had been forced to say. In retrospect, he decided that she had been more shocked by the hat than by his proposal. For while the former was a true surprise, the latter was something expected. From the very beginning, it was safely assumed by their families, and soon enough by themselves, that as long as they liked each other, their courtship would not lag, and they would surely wed. "Yes," she had told him, grinning, looking up from the hat box before he'd even had to ask. She emerges now in the snow-white terry-cloth hotel robe. She has taken off her makeup and her jewels. The vermilion with which she had stained her part at the end of the ceremony has been rinsed from her hair. Her feet are free of the 3-inch heels she had worn as soon as the religious part of the wedding was over, causing her to tower over almost everyone. This is the way he still finds her most ravishing, unadorned, aware that it is a way she is willing to look for no one but him. She sits on the edge of the mattress, applies some blue cream from a tube to her calves and the bottoms of her feet. She'd massaged the cream onto his own feet once, the day they'd walked across the Brooklyn Bridge, causing them to tingle and go cold. And then she lies against the pillows and looks at him, and puts out a hand. Underneath the robe, he expects to find some racy lingerie. Back in New York, he'd glimpsed the pile of things she'd received for her shower in the corner of the bedroom. But she is naked, her skin smelling, a little too intensely, of some sort of berry. He kisses the dark hair on her forearms, the prominent collarbone, which she had once confessed to him is her favorite part of her body. They make love in spite of their exhaustion, her damp hair limp and cool against his face, the rose petals sticking to their elbows and shoulders and calves. He breathes in the scent of her skin, still unable to fathom that they are husband and wife. When would it sink in? Even then he does not feel fully alone with her, half waiting for someone to knock on the door and tell them how to go about things. And though he desires her as much as ever, he is relieved when they are through, lying naked side by side, knowing that nothing else is expected of them, that finally they can relax. Afterward, they open up the champagne and sit together on the bed, going through a large shopping bag full of cards with personal checks inside them. The checks had been given to them by their parents' hundreds of friends. She had not wanted to register for gifts. She told Gogol it was because she didn't have the time, but he sensed that it was something she couldn't bring herself to face the second time around. It's fine with him, not to have their apartment crammed with a dozen crystal vases and platters and matching pots and pans. There's no calculator, and so they add up the figures on numerous sheets of the hotel's stationery. Most of the checks have been written out to Mr. and Mrs. Nikhil and Moushami Ganguly. Several are written to Gogol and Moushami Ganguly. The amounts are for $101, $201, occasionally $301, as Bengalis consider it inauspicious to give round figures. Gogol adds up the subtotals on each page. 7,035, he announces.
Not bad, Mr. Ganguly. I'd say we'd made a killing, Mrs. Ganguly.
Only she is not Mrs. Ganguly. Moushami has kept her last name. She doesn't adopt Ganguly, not even with a hyphen. Her own last name, Mazumdar, is already a mouthful. With a hyphenated surname, she would no longer fit into the window of a business envelope. Besides, by now she has begun to publish under Moushami Mazumdar, the name printed at the top of footnoted articles on French feminist theory in a number of prestigious academic journals that always manage to give Gogol a paper cut when he tries to read them. Though he hasn't admitted this to her, he'd hoped, the day they filled out the application for their marriage license, that she might consider otherwise, as a tribute to his father, if nothing else. But the thought of changing her last name to Ganguly has never crossed Moshumi's mind. When relatives from India continue to address letters and cards to Mrs. Moushami Ganguly, she will shake her head and sigh. They put the money toward a security deposit for a one-bedroom apartment in the 20s off 3rd Avenue. It's slightly more than they can comfortably afford, but they are won over by the maroon awning, the part-time doorman, the lobby paved with pumpkin-colored tiles. The apartment itself is small but luxurious, with built-in mahogany bookcases rising to the ceiling and dark, oily, wide-planked floors. There is a living room with a skylight, a kitchen with expensive stainless steel appliances, a bathroom with a marble floor and walls. There's a Juliet balcony off the bedroom, in one corner of which Moushami sets up her desk, her computer, and printer, her files. They're on the top floor, and if one leans far enough to the left outside the bathroom window, it's possible to see the Empire State Building. They spend a few weekends taking the shuttle bus to IKEA and filling up the rooms. Imitation Noguchi lamps, a black sectional sofa, kilim and flocati carpets, a blonde wood platform bed. Both her parents and Ashima are at once impressed and puzzled when they come to visit for the first time. Isn't it a bit small now that they are married? But Gogol and Moushami aren't thinking of children at the moment, certainly not until Moushami finishes her dissertation. On Saturdays, they shop for food at the farmer's market in Union Square, with canvas bags over their shoulders. They buy things they are not certain how to prepare, leeks and fresh fava beans and fiddleheads, looking up recipes in the cookbooks they've received for their wedding. From time to time, when they cook, they set off the fire alarm, which is overly sensitive, and they bang it into silence with the handle of a broom. They entertain together on occasion, throwing the sorts of parties their parents never had, mixing martinis in a stainless steel shaker for a few of the architects at Gogol's work or Moshimi's graduate student friends at NYU. They play bossa nova and serve bread and salami and cheese. He transfers the money in his bank account over to hers, and they have pale green checks with both their names printed in the corner. The passcode they decide on for their ATM card, Lulu, is the name of the French restaurant where they had their first meal together. They eat most nights side by side on the stools at the kitchen counter or at the coffee table, watching TV. They make Indian food infrequently. Usually it's pasta or broiled fish, or takeout from the Thai restaurant down the block. But sometimes on a Sunday, both craving the food they'd grown up eating, they ride the train out to Queens and have brunch at Jackson Diner, piling their plates with tandoori chicken and pakoras and kebabs, and shop afterward for basmati rice and the spices that need replenishing. Or they go to one of the hole-in-the-wall tea shops and drink tea in paper cups with heavy cream, asking the waitress in Bengali to bring them bowls of sweet yogurt and halim. He calls every evening before leaving the office to say he's on his way home, asks if he needs to pick up lettuce or a loaf of bread. After dinner, they watch television, as Moushami writes out thank you cards to all their parents' friends for the checks they had needed 20 different slips to deposit. These are the things that make him feel married. Otherwise, it's the same, only now they're always together. At night, she sleeps beside him, always rolling onto her stomach, waking up every morning with a pillow pressed over her head. Occasionally in the apartment, he finds odd remnants of her life before he had appeared in it, her life with Graham. The inscription to the two of them in a book of poems, a postcard from Provence stuffed into the back of a dictionary, addressed to the apartment they'd secretly shared. Once, unable to stop himself, he'd walked to this address during his lunch break, wondering what her life had been like back then. He imagined her walking along the sidewalk, carrying grocery bags from the supermarket that was on the next corner, in love with another man. He doesn't feel jealous of her past per se. It's only that sometimes Goggle wonders whether he represents some sort of capitulation or defeat. He doesn't feel this always, just enough to nag at him, settling over his thoughts like a web. But then he looks around the apartment for reassurance, reminding himself of the life they've set up together and share. He looks at the photograph taken at their wedding, in which matching garlands hang from their necks. It sits in a tasteful leather frame on top of the television set. He wanders into the bedroom where she's working, kissing her on the shoulder, drawing her to bed. But in the closet they now share is a garment bag containing a white dress he knows she would have worn a month after the Indian ceremony that had been planned for her and Graham, a second ceremony before a justice of the peace on Graham's father's lawn in Pennsylvania. She had told him about it. A patch of the dress is visible through a plastic window in the garment bag. He'd unzipped it once, glimpsed something sleeveless, to the knee, with a plain round neck, reminding him of a tennis dress. One day he asks her why she still keeps it. "Oh, that," she says with a shrug, "I keep meaning to have it dyed." In March, they go to Paris. Moshimi is invited to give a paper at a conference at the Sorbonne, and they decide to make a vacation out of it, Goggle arranging to take the week off from work. Instead of staying in a hotel, they stay in an apartment in the Bastille, which belongs to a friend of Moshimi's, a male friend named Emmanuel, a journalist who is on holiday in Greece. The apartment is barely heated, minuscule, at the top of six steep flights of stairs, with a bathroom the size of a phone booth. There is a loft bed just inches from the ceiling, so that sex is a serious hazard. An espresso pot nearly fills the narrow two-burner stove. Apart from two chairs at the dining table, there is no place to sit. The weather is raw, cheerless, the sky white, the sun perpetually hidden from view. Paris is famous for such weather, Moshimi tells him. He feels hidden himself. Men on the street stare at Moshimi constantly, their glances lingering plainly, in spite of the fact that Goggle is at her side. It is his first time in Europe, the first time he sees the sort of architecture he has read about for so many years, admired only in the pages of books and slides. For some reason, in Moshimi's company, he feels more apologetic than excited. Though they journey together one day to Chartres and another to Versailles, he has the feeling she'd rather be meeting friends for coffee, attending panels at the conference, eating at her favorite bistros, shopping at her favorite stores. From the beginning, he feels useless. Moshimi makes all the decisions, does all the talking. He is mute in the brasseries where they eat their lunches. Mute in the shops where he gazes at beautiful belts, ties, paper, pens. Mute on the rainy afternoon they spend together at the d'Orsay. He is particularly mute when he and Moshimi get together for dinners with groups of her French friends, drinking Pernod and feasting on couscous and choucroute, smoking and arguing around paper-covered tables. He struggles to grasp the topic of conversation, the Euro, Monica Lewinsky, Y2K, but everything else is a blur, indistinguishable from the clatter of plates, the drone of echoing, laughing voices. He watches them in the giant gilt-framed mirrors on the walls, their dark heads leaning close. Part of him knows this is a privilege, to be here with a person who knows the city so well, but the other part of him wants simply to be a tourist, fumbling with a phrasebook, looking at all the buildings on his list, getting lost. When he confesses his wish to Moshimi one night as they are walking back to the apartment, she says, "Why didn't you tell me that in the first place?" And the next morning, she instructs him to walk to the metro station, have his photo taken in a booth, get a carte orange. And so Goggle goes sightseeing, alone, while Moshimi is off at her conference, or as she sits at the table in the apartment and puts the final touches on her paper. His only companion is Moshimi's Plan de Paris, a small red guide to the arrondissements, with a folded map attached to the back cover. On the last page, Moshimi writes in a few phrases for his benefit, "Je voudrais un café, s'il vous plaît. Où sont les toilettes?" And she warns as he's walking out the door, "Avoid ordering a café crème unless it's morning. The French never do that.
Though the day is bright for a change, it is particularly cold, brisk air stinging his ears. He remembers his first lunch with Moshimi, the afternoon she had dragged him to the hat store. He remembers the two of them crying out in unison as the wind blasted their faces, a time too soon for them to cling to each other for warmth. He walks now to the corner, decides to get another croissant at the boulangerie where he and Moshimi go every morning to buy breakfast. He sees a young couple standing in a patch of sunlight on the sidewalk, feeding each other pastries from a bag. Suddenly he wants to return to the apartment, climb into the loft bed and forget about sightseeing, hold Moshimi in his arms. He wants to lie with her for hours, as they did at the beginning, skipping meals, then wandering the streets at odd hours, desperate for something to eat. But she must present her paper at the end of the week, and he knows she will not be roused from her task of reading it aloud, timing its duration, making small marks in the margin. He consults his map, and for the next few days he follows the routes she has charted for him with a pencil. He wanders for miles along the famous boulevards, through the Marais, arriving after many wrong turns, at the Picasso Museum. He sits on a bench and sketches the townhouses in the Place des Vosges, walks along the desolate gravel paths in the Luxembourg Gardens. Outside the Académie des Beaux-Arts, he wanders for hours through the shops selling prints, eventually buying a drawing of the Hôtel de Lausanne. He photographs the narrow sidewalks, the dark cobblestone streets, the mansard roofs, the ancient shuttered buildings of pale beige stone. All of it he finds beautiful beyond description, and yet at the same time it depresses him that none of it is new to Moshimi, that she has seen it all hundreds of times. He understands why she lived here for as long as she did, away from her family, away from anyone she knew. Her French friends adore her. Waiters and shopkeepers adore her. She both fits in perfectly, yet remains slightly novel. Here, Moshimi had reinvented herself, without misgivings, without guilt. He admires her, even resents her a little, for having moved to another country and made a separate life. He realizes that this is what their parents had done in America, what he, in all likelihood, will never do. On their last day in the morning, he shops for gifts for his in-laws, his mother Sonia. It is the day Moshimi is presenting her paper. He had offered to go with her, to sit in the audience and listen to her speak. But she told him that was silly. Why sit in the middle of a room full of people speaking a language he doesn't understand when there is still more of the city he could see? And so, after shopping, he sets off alone for the Louvre, a destination he's put off until now. At the end of the day, he meets her at a cafe in the Latin Quarter. She is there waiting for him behind a glass-tin partition on the sidewalk, wearing a dark red lipstick, sipping a glass of wine. He sits down, orders a coffee. How was it? How did it go? She lights a cigarette. Okay, over with at any rate. She looks more regretful than relieved, her eyes lingering over the small round table between them, the veins in the marble bluish, like those in cheese. Normally she wants a full account of his adventures, but today they sit silently, watching the passers-by. He shows her the things he's bought, a tie for his father-in-law, soaps for their mothers, a shirt for Samrat, a silk scarf for Sonia, sketchbooks for himself, bottles of ink, a pen. She admires the drawings he's done. It is a café they've been to before, and he feels a slight nostalgia it is sometimes possible to feel at the end of an extended stay in a foreign place, taking in the details that will soon evaporate from his mind. The surly waiter who has served them both times, the view of the shops across the street, the green and yellow straw chairs. "Are you sad to be leaving?" he asks, stirring sugar into his coffee, drinking it back in one gulp. "A little. I guess a little part of me wishes I'd never left Paris, you know?" He leans over, takes both her hands in his. "But then we would never have met," he says, with more confidence than he feels. "True," she acknowledges, and then, "Maybe we'll move here one day." He nods. "Maybe." She looks beautiful to him, tired, the concentrated light of the dying day on her face, infusing it with an amber-pink glow. He watches the smoke drift away from her. He wants to remember this moment, the two of them together, here. This is how he wants to remember Paris. He takes out his camera, focusing it on her face. "Nikhil, please don't," she says, laughing, shaking her head. "I look awful." She shields her face with the back of her hand. He still holds up the camera,
Oh, come on, Mo. You're beautiful. You look great.
But she refuses to indulge him, moving her chair out of view with a scrape on the pavement. She doesn't want to be mistaken for a tourist in the city, she says. A Saturday evening in May. A dinner party in Brooklyn. A dozen people are gathered round a long, scratched-up dining table, smoking cigarettes, drinking Chianti from juice glasses, sitting on a series of backless wooden stools. The room is dark apart from a domed metal lamp hanging from a long cord, which casts a concentrated pool of light on the table's center. An opera plays on a battered boombox on the floor. A joint is being passed around. Goggle takes a hit, but as he sits there holding his breath, he regrets it. He is already starved. Though it's close to 10 o'clock, dinner has yet to be served. Apart from the Chianti, the only offerings so far are a loaf of bread and a small bowl of olives. A blizzard of crumbs and pointy violet olive pits litter the tabletop. The bread, like a hard, dusty cushion, is full of prune-sized holes and has a crust that hurts the roof of Goggle's mouth when he chews. They are at the home of Moshimi's friends, Astrid and Donald. It is a brownstone under renovation. Astrid and Donald, expecting their first child, are in the process of expanding their domain from a single floor of the house to the top three. Thick plastic sheets hang from rafters, creating transparent, temporary corridors. Behind them, a wall is missing. Even at this hour, guests continue to arrive. They enter complaining of the cold that has persisted this far into spring, of the stinging, bothersome wind that tosses the treetops outside. They remove their coats, introduce themselves, pour themselves Chianti. If it happens to be their first time in the house, they eventually drift from the table and troop up the stairs to admire the pocket doors, the original tin ceilings, the vast space that will eventually become the nursery, the distant, sparkling view of Manhattan, visible from the top floor. Goggle has been to the house before, a bit too frequently in his opinion. Astrid is a friend of Moshimi's from Brown. The first time he'd met Donald and Astrid had been at his wedding. At least that's what Moshimi says. He doesn't remember them. They were living in Rome the first year that Goggle and Moshimi were together, on a Guggenheim that Astrid had gotten. But they've since moved back to New York, where Astrid has begun teaching film theory at the New School. Donald is a moderately talented painter of small still lives of single, everyday objects. An egg, a cup, a comb, suspended against brightly colored backgrounds. Donald's rendition of a spool of thread, a wedding present to Goggle and Moshimi, hangs in their bedroom. Donald and Astrid are a languidly confident couple, a model, Goggle guesses, for how Moshimi would like their own lives to be. They reach out to people, hosting dinner parties, bequeathing little bits of themselves to their friends. They are passionate spokespeople for their brand of life, giving Goggle and Moshimi a steady, unquestionable stream of advice about quotidian things. They swear by a certain bakery on Sullivan Street, a certain butcher on Mott, a certain style of coffee maker, a certain Florentine designer of sheets for their bed. Their decrees drive Goggle crazy, but Moshimi is loyal. She regularly goes out of her way, and thus out of their budget, to buy bread at that bakery, meat at that butcher. He recognizes a few familiar faces tonight. Edith and Colin, who teach sociology at Princeton and Yale, respectively, and Louise and Blake, both PhD candidates, like Moshimi, at NYU. Oliver is an editor at an art magazine. His wife Sally works as a pastry chef. The rest are painter friends of Donald's, poets, documentary filmmakers. They are all married. Even now, a fact as ordinary, as obvious as this, astonishes him. All married. But this is life now. The weekend sometimes more tiring than the work week. An endless stream of dinner parties, cocktail parties, occasional after-11 parties with dancing and drugs to remind them that they are still young, followed by Sunday brunches full of unlimited Bloody Marys and overpriced eggs. They are an intelligent, attractive, well-dressed crowd. Also a bit incestuous. The vast majority of them know each other from Brown, and Goggle can't ever shake the feeling that half the people in the room have slept with one another. There is the usual academic talk around the table, versions of the same conversation he can't participate in, concerning conferences, job listings, ungrateful undergraduates, proposal deadlines. At one end of the table, a woman with short red hair and cat's-eye glasses is talking about a Brecht play she'd once acted in San Francisco, performed fully in the nude. At the other end, Sally is putting the finishing touches on a dessert she's brought,
intently assembling layers and covering them with glistening white meringue that shoots up like a dense thicket of flames. Astrid is showing a few people paint chips, which she's lined up in front of her like tarot cards, versions of an apple green she and Donald are considering for the front hallway. She wears glasses that might have belonged to Malcolm X. She eyes the paint chips with precision. Though she seeks the advice of her guests, she's already made up her mind about which permutation of the shade she will choose. To Goggle's left, Edith is discussing her reasons for not eating bread. "I just have so much more energy if I stay off wheat," she maintains. Goggle has nothing to say to these people. He doesn't care about their dissertation topics, or their dietary restrictions, or the color of their walls. In the beginning, these occasions hadn't been quite so excruciating. When Moshimi had first introduced him to her crowd, he and she would sit with their arms around each other, their fellow guests a footnote to their own ongoing conversation. Once at a party at Sally and Oliver's, they'd wandered off to make quick, giddy love in Sally's walk-in closet, piles of her sweaters looming over them. He knows that that sort of insular passion can't be sustained. Still, Moshimi's devotion to these people puzzles him. He looks at her now. She's lighting a Dunhill. Her smoking hadn't bothered him initially. He liked it, after sex, when she'd lean over the bedside table and strike a match, and he would lie beside her, listening to her exhale in the quiet, watching the smoke drift up over their heads. But these days, the stale smell of it, in her hair and on her fingertips, and in the bedroom where she sits typing, slightly disgusts him, and from time to time he can't help but have a fleeting vision of himself, tragically abandoned, as a result of her mild but persistent addiction. When he'd admitted his fear to her one day, she'd laughed. "Oh, Nikhil," she'd said, "you can't be serious." She's laughing now, nodding intently at something Blake is saying. She seems animated in a way he doesn't remember her having been in a while. He looks at her straight, smooth hair, which she's had recently cut so that it flips up at the ends, the glasses that only emphasize her beauty, her pale, pretty mouth. He knows that the approval of these people means something to her, though what exactly he isn't sure. And yet, as much as Moshimi enjoys seeing Astrid and Donald, Goggle has recently begun to notice that she is gloomy in the aftermath, as if seeing them serves only to remind her that their own lives will never match up. The last time they'd gone home after one of Astrid and Donald's dinner parties, she'd picked a fight with him as soon as they'd walked in the door, complaining about the noise on Third Avenue, about the sliding doors on the closets that always fall off the rails, about the fact that it's impossible to use the bathroom without being deafened by the exhaust fan. He tells himself that it's the stress. She's been studying for her orals, holed up in her carrel at the library until 9 o'clock most nights. He remembers how it was studying for his licensing exam, which he failed twice before passing. He remembers the sustained isolation it had demanded, speaking to no one for days at a time, and so he doesn't say anything. Tonight he'd held out the hope that she'd use her orals as a reason to decline the invitation to Astrid and Donald's. But by now he's learned that there is never a question of saying no when it comes to them. It was through Astrid and Donald that Moshimi had met her former fiancé, Graham. Donald had gone to prep school with him, and he had given Moshimi's number to Graham when he had moved to Paris. Goggle doesn't like to think about the fact that Moshimi's connection to Graham persists through Astrid and Donald, that through them Moshimi has learned that Graham lives in Toronto now, is married, and a father of twins. Back when Moshimi and Graham were together, they'd made a foursome with Donald and Astrid, renting cottages together in Vermont, timeshares in the Hamptons. They tried to incorporate Goggle into similar plans. This summer, for example, they are thinking of renting a house on the coast of Brittany. Though Astrid and Donald have welcomed Goggle heartily into their lives, sometimes he has the feeling they still think she's with Graham. Once, Astrid even called him Graham by mistake. No one had noticed except Goggle. They had all been a little drunk, but he knew he had heard correctly, toward the end of an evening much like this one. "Mo, why don't you and Graham take some of this pork loin home?" Astrid had said as they'd been clearing the dishes. "It's great for sandwiches." At the moment, the guests are united in a single topic of conversation, talking about names for the baby. "What we want is something totally unique," Astrid is saying. Lately, Goggle has started to notice a trend. Now that they inhabit this world of couples, dinner party small talk gravitates to the naming of children. If a woman at the table happens to be pregnant, as Astrid is now, the subject is inevitable. "I always like the names of popes," Blake says.
You mean John and Paul? Louise asks. More like Innocent or Clement. They're nonsensical names like Jet and Tipper. These elicit groans. Someone claims to have once known a girl named Anna Graham. Get it? Anagram. And everyone laughs. Moshumi argues that a name like hers is a curse, complains that no one can say it properly, that the kids at school pronounce it Musumi and shortened it to Moose. I hated being the only Moshumi I knew, she says. See now, I'd have loved that, Oliver tells her. Goggle pours himself another juice glass of Chianti. He hates contributing to these conversations, hates listening. A number of name books are passed around the table, finding the perfect name, alternative baby names, the idiot's guide to naming your baby. One is called What Not to Name Your Baby. Pages are folded down, some with stars and checks in the margins. Someone suggests Zachary. Someone else says she once had a dog named Zachary. Everyone wants to look up his or her own name to see what it means, is by turns pleased and disappointed. Both Goggle and Moshumi are absent from these books, and for the first time all evening, he feels a hint of that odd bond that had first drawn them together. He goes over to where she is sitting, takes one of her hands, which have been resting flat on the surface of the table, her arms extended. She turns to look at him. "Hey there," she says. She smiles at him, temporarily leaning her head on his shoulder, and he realizes that she's drunk. "What does Moshumi mean?" Oliver asks on the other side of her. "A damp southwesterly breeze," she says, shaking her head, rolling her eyes. "Sort of like the one outside?"
"I always knew you were a force of nature," Astrid says, laughing.
Goggle turns to Moshumi. "Really?" he says. He realizes that it's something he'd never thought to ask about her, something he hadn't known. "You never told me that," he says. She shakes her head, confused. "I haven't?" It bothers him, though he's not quite sure why. But it's not the time to dwell on it, not in the middle of all this. He gets up to go to the bathroom. When he is finished, instead of returning to the dining room, he walks up a flight of stairs to check out the renovations. He pauses at the doors to a series of whitewashed rooms with nothing but ladders in them. Others are filled with boxes, stacked 6 or 7 deep. He stops to inspect some blueprints spread out on the floor. He remembers that when he and Moshumi were first dating, they'd spent an entire afternoon in a bar drawing a plan of the ideal house. He'd argued for something modernist, full of glass and light, but she'd wanted a brownstone like this one. In the end, they'd designed something implausible, a townhouse of poured concrete with a glass facade. It was before they'd slept together, and he remembers how they'd both grown embarrassed when deciding where the bedroom should go. He ends up in the kitchen, where Donald is only now beginning to prepare spaghetti alla vongole. It's an old kitchen from one of the former rental units, which they're using until the new one is ready. Dingy linoleum and appliances lining a single wall remind Goggle of his former place on Amsterdam Avenue. On the stove is an empty, gleaming stainless steel stockpot, so large that it covers 2 burners. Salad leaves are in a bowl covered with dampened paper towels. A heap of tiny pale green clams, no larger than quarters, soak in the deep porcelain sink. Donald is tall, wearing jeans and flip-flops and a paprika-colored shirt, whose sleeves are rolled up just above his elbows. He is handsome, with patrician features, and swept back slightly greasy light brown hair. He wears an apron over his clothes, and is busily plucking leaves from an excessively large bunch of parsley. "Hey there," Goggle says. "Need any help?" "Nikhil, welcome." Donald hands over the parsley. "Be my guest." Goggle is grateful for something to do, to be occupied and productive, even in the role of sous chef to Donald. "So how are the renovations going?"
"Don't ask," Donald says. "We just fired our contractor. At this rate, our kid will already have moved out by the time the nursery's ready."
Goggle watches as Donald begins to remove the clams from their bath, scrubbing the shells with something that looks like a tiny toilet bowl brush, then tossing them one by one into the stockpot. Goggle pokes his head into the pot and sees the vongole, their shells uniformly parted in a quietly foaming broth. "So when are you guys moving out to this neighborhood?" Donald asks. Goggle shrugs. He has no interest in moving to Brooklyn, not in such proximity to Donald and Astrid anyway. "I haven't really considered it. I prefer Manhattan. Moshumi does too." Donald shakes his head. "You're wrong. Moshumi adores Brooklyn. We practically had to kick her out after the whole Graham thing." The mention of the name pricks him, deflates him as it always does.
She stayed here with you? Right down the hall. She was here for a couple of months. She was a real mess. I've never seen anyone so devastated. He nods. This was something else she'd never told him. He wonders why. He hates the house suddenly, aware that it was here, with Donald and Astrid, that she spent her darkest hour, that it was here she'd mourned for another man. But you're much better for her, Donald concludes. Goggle looks up, surprised. Don't get me wrong, Graham's a great guy, but they were too alike somehow, too intense together. Goggle does not find this observation particularly reassuring. He finishes plucking the last of the parsley leaves, watches as Donald grabs a knife and chops them, expertly and swiftly, a hand held flat over the top of the blade. Goggle feels incompetent all of a sudden. I've never quite figured out how to do that, he says. All you need is a really good knife, Donald tells him. I swear by these. Goggle is sent off with a stack of plates, a bunch of forks and knives. On his way, he pokes his head into the room down the hall where Moshimi had stayed. It's empty now. A drop cloth on the floor, a tangle of wires poking out of the center of the ceiling. He imagines her in a bed in the corner, sullen, emaciated, a cloud of smoke over her head. Downstairs, he takes his place beside Moshimi. She kisses his earlobe. Where did you wander off to? Just keeping Donald company. The name conversation is still going full force. Colin says he likes names that signify virtue, patience, faith, chastity. He says his great-grandmother was named Silence, something nobody wants to believe. What about prudence? Isn't prudence one of the virtues? Donald says, coming down the stairs with a platter of spaghetti. The platter is lowered onto the table to scattered applause. The pasta is served, the plates passed around. It just feels like such a huge responsibility to name a baby. What if he hates it? Astrid frets. So he'll change it, Louise says. By the way, remember Joe Chapman from college? I heard he's a Joanne now. God, I would never change my name, Edith says. It's my grandmother's. Nickel changed his, Moshimi blurts out suddenly. And for the first time all evening, with the exception of the opera singers, the room goes completely quiet. He stares at her, stunned. He has never told her not to tell anyone. He simply assumed she never would. His expression is lost on her. She smiles back at him, unaware of what she's done. The dinner guests regard him, their mouths hanging open in confused smiles. What do you mean he changed his name? Blake asks slowly. Nikhil. It wasn't the name he was born with. She nods, her mouth full, tossing a clamshell onto the table. Not his name when we were kids. What name were you born with? Astrid says, looking at him suspiciously, her eyebrows furrowed for effect. For a few seconds, he says nothing. Goggle, he says finally. It has been years since he's been Goggle to anyone other than his family, their friends. It sounds as it always does. Simple, impossible, absurd. He stares at Moshimi as he says it, but she's too drunk to absorb his reproach. As in the overcoat? Sally asks. I get it, Oliver says. Nick Olai, Goggle. I can't believe you've kept this from us, Nick, Astrid chides. What in the world made your parents choose that name? Donald wants to know. He thinks back to the story he cannot bring himself to tell these people, at once as vivid and as elusive as it's always been. The capsized train in the middle of the night, his father's arm sticking through a window, the crumpled page of a book clutched in his fist. It's a story he had told Moshimi in the months after they first met. He had told her of the accident, and then he had told her about the night his father had told him, in the driveway at Pemberton Road. He had confessed to her that he still felt guilty at times for changing his name, more so now that his father was dead. And she'd assured him that it was understandable, that anyone in his place would have done the same. But now it's become a joke to her. Suddenly he regrets having ever told Moshimi. He wonders whether she'll proclaim the story of his father's accident to the table as well. By morning, half the people in the room will have forgotten. It will be a tiny, odd fact about him. An anecdote, perhaps, for a future dinner party. This is what upsets him most. My father was a fan, he says finally. Then maybe we should call the baby Verdi, Donald muses, just as the opera surges to its closing bars and the tape ends with a click. You're not helping, Astrid says, petulant, kissing Donald on the nose. Goggle watches them, knowing that it's all in jest. They're not the type to do something so impulsive, so naive, to blunder as his own parents had done. Relax, Edith says. The perfect name will come to you in time. Which is when Goggle announces, there's no such thing.
No such thing as what?
Astrid says.
There's no such thing as a perfect name.
I think that human beings should be allowed to name themselves when they turn 18, he adds. Until then, pronouns.
People shake their heads dismissively. Moshimi shoots him a look that he ignores.
The salad is served. The conversation takes a new turn, carries on without him. And yet he can't help but recall a novel he'd once picked up from a pile on Moshimi's side of the bed, an English translation of something French, in which the main characters were simply referred to, for hundreds of pages, as he and she. He had read it in a matter of hours, oddly relieved that the names of the characters were never revealed. It had been an unhappy love story. If only his own life were so simple.
Chapter 10, 1999. On the morning of their first anniversary, Moshimi's parents call waking them, wishing them a happy anniversary before they've had the chance to say it to each other. In addition to their anniversary, there's something else to celebrate. Moshimi successfully passed her orals the week before, is now officially ABD. There's a third thing we're celebrating but which she hasn't mentioned. She's been awarded a research fellowship to work on her dissertation in France for the year. She'd applied for the grant secretly, just before the wedding, simply curious to see if she'd get it. It was always good practice, she'd reasoned, to strive for such things. 2 years ago, she would have said yes on the spot. But it's no longer possible to fly off to France for the year, now that she has a husband, a marriage, to consider. So when the good news came, she decided it was easier to decline the fellowship quietly, to file away the letter, not to bring it up. She's taken the initiative for the evening, making reservations at a place in Midtown, which Donald and Astrid have recommended. She feels a bit guilty for all these months of studying, aware that with her exams as an excuse, she has ignored Nikhil, perhaps more than necessary. There are nights that she told him she was at her carol in the library, when she'd really met Astrid and her baby, Esme, in Soho, or gone for a walk by herself. Sometimes she would sit at a restaurant alone, at the bar, ordering sushi or a sandwich and a glass of wine, simply to remind herself that she was still capable of being on her own. This assurance is important to her, along with the Sanskrit vows she'd repeated at her wedding. She'd privately vowed that she'd never grow fully dependent on her husband, as her mother has. For even after 32 years abroad, in England and now in America, her mother does not know how to drive, does not have a job, does not know the difference between a checking and a savings account. And yet she's a perfectly intelligent woman, was an honor student in philology at Presidency College before she was married off at 22. They've both dressed up for the occasion. When she emerges from the bathroom, she sees that he is wearing the shirt she's given him, moss-colored with a velvet Nehru collar of slightly darker green. It was only after the salesman had wrapped it that she'd remembered the rule about giving paper on the first anniversary. She considered saving the shirt for Christmas, going to Rizzoli, and buying him an architecture book instead. But there hadn't been time. She is wearing the black dress she'd worn the first time he'd come to dinner, the first time they'd slept together, and over it, a lilac pashmina shawl, Nikhil's anniversary present to her. She still remembers their very first date, liking the slightly untamed look of his hair as he'd approached her at the bar, the dark pine stubble on his cheeks, the shirt he'd worn with green stripes and thinner stripes of lavender, the collar beginning to fray. She still remembers her bewilderment, looking up from her book and seeing him, her heart skipping, feeling the attraction instantly, powerfully in her chest. For she had been expecting an older version of the boy she remembered, distant, quiet, in corduroy jeans and a sweatshirt, a few pimples dotting his chin. The day before the date, she'd had lunch with Astrid. I just don't see you with some Indian guy, Astrid had said dismissively over salads at City Bakery.
At the time, Moshimi had not protested, maintaining apologetically that it was just one date. She'd been deeply skeptical herself. Apart from the young Shashi Kapoor and a cousin in India, she had never until then found herself attracted to an Indian man. But she'd genuinely liked Nikhil. She'd liked that he was neither a doctor nor an engineer. She'd liked that he had changed his name from Goggle to Nikhil. Though she'd known him all those years, it was a thing that made him somehow new, not the person her mother had mentioned. They decided to walk to the restaurant, 30 blocks north of their apartment, 4 blocks west. Though it's dark already, the evening is pleasantly warm, so much so that she hesitates under the awning of their building, wondering if the pashmina is necessary. She has nowhere to put it. Her evening bag is too small. She lets the shawl drop from her shoulders, gathers it up in her hands. Maybe I should leave this upstairs. What if we want to walk back? He says. You'll probably need it then. I guess. It looks nice on you, by the way. Do you remember this dress? He shakes his head. She's disappointed but not surprised. By now she's learned that his architect's mind for detail fails when it comes to everyday things. For example, he had not bothered to hide the receipt for the shawl, leaving it, along with change emptied from his pocket, on top of the bureau they share. She can't really blame him for not remembering. She herself can no longer remember the exact date of that evening. It had been a Saturday in November, but now those landmarks in their courtship have faded, have given way to the occasion they are now celebrating. They walk up Fifth Avenue, past the stores that sell oriental carpets, unfurled in illuminated windows, past the public library. Instead of proceeding to the restaurant, they decide to wander up the sidewalk for a while. There are still 20 minutes before their reservation. Fifth Avenue is eerily uncluttered, only a handful of people and cabs in a neighborhood usually choked with shoppers and tourists. She comes here seldom, only to buy makeup at Bendel's, or to see the odd movie at the Paris, and once with Graham and his father and stepmother to have drinks at the plaza. They walk past the windows of closed shops displaying watches, luggage, trench coats. A pair of turquoise sandals causes Moshimi to stop. The shoes are arranged on a lucite pedestal, glowing under a spotlight, the gladiator-style straps festooned with rhinestones. "Ugly or beautiful?" she asks him. It is a question she poses to him often, as they leaf together through apartments featured in Architectural Digest or the design section of the Times magazine. Often his answers surprise her, convincing her to appreciate an object she would have otherwise dismissed. "I'm pretty certain they're ugly, but I would have to see them on." "I agree. Guess how much they cost," she says. $200? Five. Can you believe it? I saw them featured in Vogue. She begins to walk away. After a few paces, she turns back and sees that he's still standing there, bent down to see if there's a price tag on the bottom of the shoe. There is something at once innocent and irreverent about the gesture, and she is reminded forcefully of why she still loves him. It reminds her of how grateful she'd felt when he had reappeared in her life. By the time she'd met him, she'd begun to fear that she was retreating into her former self, before Paris, untouched, bookish, alone. She recalled the panic she'd felt, all her friends married. She'd even considered placing a personal ad. But he had accepted her, had obliterated her former disgrace. She believed that he would be incapable of hurting her as Graham had. After years of clandestine relationships, it felt refreshing to court in a fishbowl, to have the support of her parents from the very start, the inevitability of an unquestioned future, of marriage, drawing them along. And yet the familiarity that had once drawn her to him has begun to keep her at bay. Though she knows it's not his fault, she can't help but associate him, at times, with a sense of resignation, with the very life she had resisted, had struggled so mightily to leave behind. He was not who she saw herself ending up with. He had never been that person. Perhaps for those very reasons, in those early months, being with him, falling in love with him, doing precisely what had been expected of her for her entire life, had felt forbidden, wildly transgressive, a breach of her own instinctive will. They can't find the restaurant at first, though they have the exact address, written on a slip of folded paper in Moshimi's evening bag. It leads them only to a suite of offices in a townhouse. They press the buzzer, peer through the glass door into the empty, carpeted foyer, at a big vase of flowers at the foot of the stairs. "It can't be this," she says, putting her hands up to the glass, shielding either side of her face in order to block out the glare. "Are you sure you wrote down the address right?" Goggle asks. They wander partway up and down the block, look on the other side. They return to the townhouse, looking up at the darkened windows for signs of life. "There it is," he says, noticing a couple emerging from a basement door below the steps. There, in an entryway lit by a single sconce, they find a plaque nailed discreetly into the facade of the building bearing the restaurant's name, Antonia. A small fleet gathers to welcome them, to tick their names off a list at a podium, to lead them to their table. The fuss feels unwarranted as they step into a stark, sunken dining room. The atmosphere is somber, vaguely abandoned, as the streets had been. There's a family eating after the theater, she guesses. The two small daughters in absurdly fancy dresses, with petticoats and large lacy collars. There are a few wealthy-looking middle-aged couples in suits. A well-dressed elderly gentleman is dining alone. She finds it suspicious that there are so many empty tables, that no music plays. She'd been hoping for something more bustling, warmer. Given that it's subterranean, the place seems surprisingly vast, the ceilings high. The air conditioning is too strong, chilling her bare legs and arms. She wraps the pashmina tightly around her shoulders. I'm freezing. Do you think they'd turn down the AC if I asked? I doubt that. Would you like my jacket? Nikhil offers. No, it's okay. She smiles at him. And yet she feels uncomfortable, depressed. She is depressed by the pair of teenaged Bangladeshi busboys who wear tapestry waistcoats and black trousers, serving them warm bread with silver tongs. It annoys her that the waiter, perfectly attentive, looks neither of them in the eye as he describes the menu, speaking instead to the bottle of mineral water positioned between them. She knows it's too late to change their plans now, but even after they place their order, a part of her has a nagging urge, feels like standing up, leaving. She had done something similar a few weeks ago, sitting in the chair of an expensive hair salon, walking out after the apron had been tied behind her neck, while the stylist had gone to check on another client, simply because something about the stylist's manner, the bored expression on her face as she'd lifted a lock of Moshimi's hair and studied it in the mirror, had felt insulting. She wonders what Donald and Astrid like about this place, decides it must be the food. But when it arrives, it too disappoints her. The meal, served on square white plates, is fussily arranged, the portions microscopically small. As usual, they trade plates partway through the meal, but this time she doesn't like the taste of his, so she sticks to her own. She finishes her entree of scallops too quickly, sits for a very long time, it seems, watching Nikhil work his way through his quail. We shouldn't have come here, she says suddenly, frowning. Why not? He looks approvingly around the room. It's nice enough. I don't know. It's not what I thought it would be. Let's just enjoy ourselves. But she is not able to enjoy herself. As they near the end of the meal, it occurs to her that she is neither very drunk nor full. In spite of two cocktails and the bottle of wine they've shared, she feels distressingly sober. She looks at the hair-thin quail bones Nikhil has discarded on his plate and is faintly repulsed, wishing he'd finish so that she could light her after-dinner cigarette. Madam, your shawl, one of the busboys says, picking it up from the floor and handing it to her. Sorry, she says, feeling clumsy, unkempt. Then she notices that her black dress is coated with lilac fibers. She brushes at the material, but the fibers cling stubbornly like cat hair. What's the matter? Nikhil asks, looking up from his plate. Nothing, she says, not wanting to hurt his feelings, to find fault with his costly gift. They are the last of the diners to leave. It's been wildly expensive, far more than they'd expected. They put down a credit card. Watching Nikhil sign the receipt, she feels cheap all of a sudden, irritated that they have to leave such a generous tip, though there had been no real reason to fault the waiter's performance. She notices that a number of tables have already been cleared, chairs placed upside down on their surfaces. I can't believe they're already stripping the tables. He shrugs. It's late. They probably close early on Sundays. You'd think they could wait for us to leave, she says. She feels a lump form in her throat, tears filming her eyes. Moshimi, what's wrong? Is there something you want to talk about? She shakes her head. She doesn't feel like explaining. She wants to be home, crawl into bed, put the evening behind her. Outside, she's relieved that it's drizzling, so that instead of walking back to the apartment as they'd planned, they can hail a cab. Are you sure nothing's wrong? He says that they are riding home. He's beginning to lose patience with her, she can tell. I'm still hungry, she says, looking out the window, at the restaurant still open at this hour. Brashly lit diners with specials scrawled on paper plates. Cheap calzone places with sawdust-coated floors. The type of restaurant she would never think to enter normally, but which suddenly look enticing. I could eat a pizza. 2 days later, a new semester begins. It's Moshimi's 8th semester at NYU. She's finished with classes, will never in her life take a class again. Never again will she sit for an exam. This fact delights her. Finally, a formal emancipation from studenthood. Though she still has a dissertation to write, still has an advisor to monitor her progress. She feels unmoored already, somehow beyond the world that has defined and structured and limited her for so long. This is the third time she's taught the class. Beginning French, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, a total of 3 hours a week. All she's had to do is look ahead in her calendar and change the date of the class meetings. Her biggest effort will be to learn her students' names. She's always flattered when they assume she herself is French or half-French. She enjoys their looks of disbelief when she tells them she's from New Jersey, born to Bengali parents. Moshimi's been given an 8 a.m. section, something that had annoyed her at first. But now that she's up, showered, dressed, walking down the street, a latte from the deli on their block in one hand, she's invigorated. Being out at this hour already feels like an accomplishment. When she'd left the apartment, Nicola had still been asleep, undisturbed by the persistent beeping of the alarm. The night before, she'd laid out her clothes, her papers, something she had not done since she was a girl preparing for school. She likes walking through the streets so early, had liked rising by herself in semi-darkness, liked the sense of promise it lent the day. It's a pleasant change from their usual routine. Nikhil showered in his suit, flying out the door as she's just pouring herself a first cup of coffee. She's thankful not to have to face her desk in the corner of their bedroom first thing. Surrounded as it is by sacks full of dirty clothes they keep meaning to drop off at the laundry, but get around to only once a month, when buying new socks and underwear becomes necessary. Moshimi wonders how long she will live her life with the trappings of studenthood, in spite of the fact that she is a married woman, that she's as far along in her studies as she is, that Nikhil has a respectable, if not terribly lucrative, job. It would have been different with Graham. He'd made more than enough money for both of them. And yet that, too, had been frustrating, causing her to fear that her career was somehow an indulgence, unnecessary. Once she has a job, a real full-time tenure-track job, she reminds herself things will be different. She imagines where that first job might take her, assumes it will be in some far-flung town in the middle of nowhere. Sometimes she jokes with Nikhil about their having to pick up and move, in a few years, to Iowa, to Kalamazoo. But they both know it's out of the question for him to leave New York, that she will be the one to fly back and forth on weekends. There's something appealing to her about this prospect, to make a clean start in a place where no one knows her, as she had done in Paris. It's the one thing about her parents' lives she truly admires, their ability, for better or for worse, to turn their back on their homes. As she approaches the department, she sees that something is wrong. An ambulance is parked on the sidewalk. The doors at the back flung open. Static crackles from a paramedic's walkie-talkie. She peeks into the ambulance as she crosses the street. She sees the resuscitative equipment but no people. The sight causes her to shudder, nevertheless. Upstairs, the hallway is crowded. She wonders who's hurt, whether it's a student or a professor. She recognizes no one, only a group of bewildered-looking freshmen bearing ad drop forms. "I think someone fainted," people are saying. "I have no idea." A door opens and they are told to make way. She expects to see someone in a wheelchair, is startled to see a body covered by a sheet, being carried out on a stretcher. A number of onlookers cry out in alarm. Moshimi's hand goes to her mouth. Half the crowd is looking down, away, shaking their heads. From the splayed feet at one end of the stretcher, wearing a pair of beige flat-heeled shoes, she can tell that it's a woman. From a professor, she learns what happened. Alice, the administrative assistant, had fallen suddenly by the mailboxes. One minute she was sorting campus mail, the next minute she was out cold. By the time the paramedics had arrived, she was dead from an aneurysm. She was in her 30s, unmarried, perpetually sipping herbal tea. Moshimi had never been particularly fond of her. There had been a brittle quality to her, something unyielding, a young person who carried about her a premonition of old age. Moshimi feels sick at the thought of it, of a death so sudden, of a woman so marginal and yet so central to her world. She enters the office she shares with the other TAs, empty now. She calls Nikhil at home, at work, no answer. She looks at her watch, realizes he must be on the subway, on his way to work. Suddenly she's glad he's unreachable. She's reminded of the way Nikhil's father had died, instantly, without warning. Surely this would remind him of that. She has the urge to leave campus, go back to the apartment. But she has a class to teach in half an hour. She goes back to the Xerox room to copy her syllabus and a short passage from Flaubert to translate in class. She pushes the button to collate the syllabus, but forgets to push the button for Staples. She searches in the supply closet for a stapler, and when she fails to find one, goes instinctively to Alice's desk. The phone is ringing. A cardigan is draped over the back of the chair. She opens up Alice's drawer, afraid to touch anything. She finds a stapler behind paper clips and sweet and low packets in the drawer. Alice is written on masking tape stuck